visited every Tuesday between 3:30 and 4 o'clock here on Fresh Air. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is Amos Vogel, who's worked with art films and independent and experimental films since about 1947, when he founded Cinema 16, which became America's largest film society. From there, he became the director of the New York Film Festival, and then spent 4 years as the director of the film department at Lincoln Center. He's currently the director of film for the Annenberg Center at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a professor in the Annenberg School of Communication. You may have read his pieces in Film Comment, The Village Voice, and his articles in the New York Times and Film Culture. Amos Vogel is also the author of The Film as a Subversive Art, in which he discusses how films have used visual taboos like sex and violence. Later this week, Thursday night, he'll be hosting a new series on Channel 12 called Real Philadelphia, an Unusual Film Series. And this series will feature films by Philadelphia independent filmmakers. The series will be shown the second Thursday of each month between 9:30 and 11 in the evening on Channel 12. Amos Vogel, welcome to Fresh Air.
Welcome. I mean, I'm happy to be here. That's what I meant to say.
How did you first get excited about film? You've been working in film for many years. You must have had a very strong relationship as a viewer to it before you became involved professionally.
Yes, that's true. I think it goes back to about age 10, in fact. I was born in Vienna, and I was able there to see a great many both European and what to us at the time were foreign films, namely American films. And I also belonged to a film society as a kid, and I remember being very impressed by particularly the British documentary film movement of that period, and by such Hollywood films as Busby Berkeley and Eddie Cantor, and certain of the German Expressionist films, the early Soviet Russian films. This is all as an early, you know, adolescent, really. So it's quite obvious that even, you know, when I was quite young, I was already in one way or the other involved with this medium.
How did you see American films at that time?
Very well projected, excellent prints with German subtitles.
What was your impression of the American cinema?
Oh, I was, at the time, I should say, I was very much taken by it, very fascinated by it. I would say that all major American films came to Europe at the time, only the major ones, not, you know, minor ones. And probably my opinion of these films was higher then than it is now, to be quite frank about it.
Why is that?
I've learned more about cinema and more about what cinema can be and how narrow and constricted and confined, in a sense, the Hollywood, the so-called great Hollywood cinema of the 30s, 40s, 50s really was. It's only, to me, it's only one aspect of what film really is or can be. There are great artists working in film everywhere who are not, who cannot be characterized as being part of the so-called golden era of the Hollywood period in America. So I've just learned much more than I knew then, you know. I was an innocent consumer, probably with a fairly good eye, visual, you know, sensibility. But since then I found out there are many, many other things that can be done in film and make it richer.
As someone who has worked with this for many years, what do you consider to be some of the differences for a viewer between seeing a movie and, say, going to the theater or watching television? Because it seems to be a very different kind of relationship.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, if you go to a theater and you have a seat in a second balcony, your distance to the action remains the same throughout. When you go to a film, your distance changes continuously. Not only your distance, but the angle of vision. Every single aspect of the scene can change. You're suddenly transported from New York to India, or into outer space, or into the Middle Ages, or into the future. Now, in theater, this is much more difficult, of course, to do. There have been certain attempts to create a more fluid kind of staging. But I must say, and I'm speaking, of course, in a totally subjective fashion as a film person, that to me, the film is a much more rewarding, emotionally rewarding, and a richer experience, really, than the theater.
You're not supposed to say that, by the way, right?
Why?
Because theater is supposed to I think this is the way the story goes. The theater's supposed to be richer because you've got real people on stage, and it's a more personal relationship, and it's a three-dimensional image with real things as opposed to a two-dimensional series of shadows being projected.
I'm glad you used the term, that's the way the story goes, you said, because my whole life is devoted to showing that there are other stories and that there isn't such a thing as only one story. So in relation to that, yes, of course, I think that's wonderful to have three-dimensional actors and all that. On the other hand, I have not the slightest doubt that people who go to films and love them, and that's probably, of course, the major part of the population anyway, because I'm not discussing now the type of film, but rather the actor film going. I have not the slightest doubt that for all those people, those so-called two-dimensional shadows are three-dimensional real people up there. It's very strange and subject to research why this should be so, but I have no doubt about it, of course. It's real. Now, then you ask about television. Well, of course, that's, again, a very different experience, partly because we are still in the early stages of television and we live in a particular country. Early stages means we're still working with very small screens, generally speaking. That, to me, makes a tremendous difference. I mean, to me, a large screen and the kind of projection you get in terms of film, 35mm film, is far superior to the image you get on television. The cable image comes closer to 35mm film, you know, cable television, than anything else. But the size of the image is entirely too small. Then when I go to a movie house, of course, the theater is completely dark. I'm enveloped by darkness, and it's a kind of semi-hypnotic state that sets in, which is totally missing for me at home. I have distractions all over the place. The mise-en-scène, or the decor that surrounds me, is not just in the tube, but, you know, my family, the furniture, a doorbell ringing. And then, let's not forget for a moment, and I take this very seriously, although so many jokes are being made about it constantly, the commercials. Which to me is a horrifying distraction, and actually dehumanizing distraction.
Do you watch much TV?
Let's put it this way. Compared to the average, no. For myself, enough. I have no objections to the medium whatsoever. I have a great deal of objection to the use of the medium at the present time.
That's an interesting distinction, since many people don't make that distinction and think that the medium is inherently evil.
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think necessarily, well, I was going to say anything is inherently evil, but I don't know if I'm prepared to extend this to, let's say, atomic and hydrogen bombs. So,
some of the research that's been being done, that the flickering of TV interferes with the brain waves,
yes,
in some way, and it's hypnotic, and
yes,
you lose energy watching it.
Yes, I know about that. I think it's interesting to read about. I don't think it has yet really been proven. I don't know whether it ever will be, not having done this kind of research myself. I think there, too, we're just at the beginning, and we may indeed find out, as we now do, say, about the pollution of rivers or air or what have you, that there was something there that in some way might have been harmful to us and we weren't aware of it. On the other hand, we may find nothing. I think what we see, without any reference to these physiological factors, what we actually see is more harmful than the process by which it's being brought to us.
Were people ever afraid of film when the medium was new, that the act of seeing a film was somehow going to interfere with your brain processes?
No, there were always people who complained about getting headaches from swiftly moving images, but I've seen no studies that I know of, you know, that anything else could have happened. And I don't mean to give the impression that I think that there is anything physiologically harmful in television. No, that's not my intention at all.
Amos Vogel, in the mid-1970s, you wrote a book called Film as a Subversive Art, and in it you discuss a lot of the taboos that can be and sometimes are shown within a film. And I'd like to spend some time talking about some of the ideas that you cover in that and see what you're thinking about that now.
Can I just say one thing about that? The book is really, it's really an attempt it goes far beyond the taboos. It's really an attempt to discuss how film can be a subverting type of art, both in terms of form and content. Content definitely includes taboo, and you're quite right, and in fact, that's an important basic part of the book. On the other hand, content also includes, say, political films of various types that can clearly be subversive in all directions. You know, just as there can be subversive political films in this country, there can be in Eastern Europe, let's say, and have been, in fact. And finally, subversion in terms of form is also very important. I'm referring to the fact that the style of the film, the particular codes used by the filmmaker, the ways of expression themselves can be a subversion either of previous styles, of accepted styles, of the way things are, you know, as you said earlier, and thereby also themselves become a part of the subversive process. Now, taboo is an essential part, and I'm delighted to attempt to answer any questions you may have, if I can.
I wonder, first of all, how taboos have changed, even from the time you wrote the book and now. Now, you went back in history and talked a little bit about sexuality, visual showing of sexuality as a taboo. Now, what do you think it means that there is a lot more flesh that's shown, a lot more sexuality, pornography, X-rated films are readily accessible if you're above the age? Do you think that indicates something about the way the American society deals with sex, or what can we make out of that?
Well, of course, this is a huge subject. First of all, a very definite distinction has to be made between, let's call it, mainline cinema and something out on the outer fringes. Because in terms of the movie houses, in terms of the regular commercial cinema that you go to, films that you go to when you go out in the evening on the town, I'm not talking about the hardcore pornography houses now, but in terms of these regular movie houses, not very much has changed. There have been certain changes, but when I think back, say, at the period in which there was national censorship in America, state censorship by individual states in the 60s, for example, 50s, 40s, there have been some changes, but they have not been as profound as people seem to think. You have to be very concrete about these things. For example, you will, in the regular commercial movie houses, you will rarely, if ever, see frontal female nudity. And when it comes to male nudity, you will not. I mean, the penis is strictly forbidden and remains, you know, one of the taboos of that kind of cinema anyway. Now, needless to say, intercourse itself will not be shown. It may be simulated, which is different from films of the 50s, say. But even that's done in a very cautious fashion because of the rating system, you know, the XR and what have you. And that has economic consequences. If you're in the wrong category, you know, you lose half your audience or whatever. So filmmakers are very afraid of that, or rather the people who give them money to make films, even more so. Now then, there are the pornography houses. And that, of course, is a new development. We didn't have that before in America until, you know, fairly recently. And I think, and I'm sure that I'm being highly unpopular, but I think in a certain respect, the open existence of such theaters, from my point of view, is actually a step forward.
Why?
Yep. Well, because I think that we live in a sexually repressed society on a very deep, profound, and all-pervasive level. People are usually not even aware of that. And they think they are free when indeed they are not. And these movie houses now present films that show, although in a very vulgar, crude, mechanical fashion, they show certain basic mechanisms or processes of life without which, indeed, life could not exist. And I've always wondered why it is precisely one of the most basic human experiences, namely sex, sexuality, why it is this that cannot be shown. And of course, that goes back to the whole question of the nature of the taboo in human society. What is it about it that makes it unshowable? And as far as I'm concerned, being in favor of a, how should we say, freer type of human existence than we now have in all aspects, I definitely include sexuality, and I feel that it should not be repressed. It should be accepted as a normal human part of life. So from that point of view, I consider this indeed a step forward. I'm totally aware of the crass commercialization of this phenomenon. I have, of course, a full understanding of the fact that the people who produce these films don't do them in order to bring about sexual liberation, although some of them say so, but rather they do it to make money. But, you know, the making money is the same thing as making money on Jaws or on the horror films and the very violent films that are now available in the commercial movie houses. And sometimes I even go so far in these unpopular views that I express here in my own thinking as to say to myself, you know, what is really so much more acceptable and so much more permissible about showing people's heads being blown off or arms chopped off or the type of violence you can now see, very gory and detailed violence in the regular movies. Why is that preferable, or why is that okay, in quotes, while on the other hand, the showing of an act of sexual intercourse between two human beings is not. I'm not sure that if you want to talk about obscenity, that perhaps the other isn't more obscene. Or let's go a step further. I think the use, the production, the use, the display of weapons and weapon systems, isn't that in a sense equally obscene, or perhaps more so? It serves to destroy human beings. I have not yet heard of human beings being destroyed by sexual intercourse, you know, unless it's an old man who collapses from a heart attack. I've heard of these things. Otherwise, it seems to be a fairly, enjoyable and positive experience. So, you know, in a sense, these films of violence and, say, documentary shots of the damage done at Hiroshima, or documentary newsreel type of material concerning weapons, represent an invocation of death. While, on the other hand, these much maligned pornographic films, in a certain peculiar sense, represent something about life. Now that's, I don't expect everybody to agree with this kind of statement, nor am I spending my time in movie houses showing pornographic films, but I did want to make that point.
So you don't think it's really useful or necessary to have sexual taboos on the screen?
I do not personally favor taboos in general, wherever they may be or may occur, of any sort.
Okay, well then,
how's that?
let's look at violence then. Now, I remember that there was always a taboo of showing really open wounds, of showing operating scenes. You wouldn't see a close-up on the body being cut open. But
I'm not
even
in favor of that.
Even in a musical like Bob Fosse's film, All That Jazz, there's a close-up of open-heart surgery that's actually documentary footage from a real operation.
Yes.
And that's an example of taboo being violated right there. In violence or in surgical matters or, you know, organs or parts of the body, do you think that taboos serve any function there, useful function for us?
From my point of view, no, because one of the problems I think we have with human life, you know, all my opinions ultimately go back to a real, you know, you might say Weltanschauung, a worldview of that I have. I feel that in general, we are not sufficiently in touch with ourselves as human beings. And there is a kind of repression in a great many different areas and a kind of mystification. And I'm against that. You know, I think we should be able to look at ourselves the way we are, or closer to the way we are than we do at the present time. So that I've always been against, I remember, you know, when I was younger, we had the censorship system in the United States, legal censorship. And for example, I'll give you one example. I showed a documentary film about cats, made by Maya Deren, in fact, an important independent American filmmaker, and her husband, Alexander Hammett. And they made a 20-minute film about their cats at home, a sort of a home movie, beautiful film, very sensitive about the cats together, and then the kittens, and how they are taught various things in life, etc. Very charming. Well, in there, there was a sequence showing the birth of kittens. And the New York State Censorship Board prohibited the public showing of the film at the time as obscene because of that one sequence. And I still have the framed, you know, the official document from the censorship board showing me that indeed there were some human beings around who thought that this was obscene. Well, you see, this extends into a great many different areas. I think people should be able to look at operations because all it does is to show you what you look like on the inside, how fragile you are, how you can sometimes be helped by doctors. And, you know, you are a biological organism, not some mystical, mysterious, inexplicable thing, but something very clear and definite, and why not show it? And that extends, as far as I'm concerned, to all areas. In short, there's an old saying that went something like this: nothing human is alien to me. I subscribe to that. Whatever human beings are capable of, or do, or are, I think we ought to be able to see it. And if they're doing something terribly unforgivable or criminal, well, then we should see it in order to find out or to learn how not to do it. But rather, we should rather see it than to avert our eyes and to pretend it doesn't exist, or to say it mustn't be shown, or to say, I can see it. That's the most pernicious types of censorship at all. I can see it, but somebody else cannot see it. That's very pernicious. I am good enough to be allowed to see it, but somebody else cannot see it. I don't know who gives me that right to make such a decision. So actually, I'm obviously, in terms of what I've said, against censorship in all its forms.
There are some images that you may, after having seen it, regret that you saw. For instance, something like open heart surgery. Say you have a weak heart and you might be a candidate for that operation someday. You might feel like you'd prefer to enter that operation not knowing the specifics of what was going to happen to you, so you wouldn't have to wake up from a very explicit dream of your body looking exactly the way it was going to look when the doctors cut you open. There's some things you prefer to not know about. And that's not meant to be an argument for censorship, but maybe trying to find a reason why there are taboos, why we try to protect ourselves from
certain things.
All you
have to do then is close your eyes, number one, or turn your head away, or walk out of the movie house, or never enter it. But as you and I know, while some people may not want to see such images, a certain image, other people might. In certain hospitals, in fact, in terms of open heart surgery, in certain hospitals now in America, the patients are shown films beforehand as to what that operation will be like, and some people really want to see it. If you want my opinion, I would prefer to see it than not to see it. So therefore, all I'm saying is we all have different levels of, shall we say, acceptance or tolerance. All I'm saying is, you should not tell me what I should see, and I'm not going to tell you what you should see. But let's not keep each other from seeing anything. That's as far as I'm concerned. You get it?
Now, let's apply this to violence. Many people are afraid that with all the violent movies that are showing around now in commercial movie houses, that it's almost encouraging people to go out and commit acts of violence. And some filmmakers say, no, that's not true. By seeing how awful murder is and how terrible a painful death is, people will be sensitized to it and discouraged from committing these kinds of acts, or more horrified by the thought of murder. I wonder if you think that violent films sensitize or immunize the audience.
Well, you see, that's a... by the way, all these questions are very, very complex, and I'm sure that some of the things I say here lend themselves to, either misunderstanding or that I'm actually contradicting myself in certain instances. That's fine. You know, that's the way we learn, by groping among ignorance for some knowledge anyway. But I belong to a particular group of people, based on a certain amount of research, I should say, a group of people who feel that actually when you see certain things in the movies, whatever they may be, they in a sense keep you from actions that you might otherwise perform, rather than encourage you to go out and do them. What I mean by that is it serves as a kind of a safety valve. It's a place, again, we're talking about total darkness, being alone, being anonymous, where you can live out your fantasies, daydreams, and nightmares, repressed wishes that you cannot carry out in real life. But you know this film is going to be about that, and you go in there and sort of through some interesting mechanisms, psychological mechanisms, you pretend that you are really the person up on the screen. I'll put it any way you want. But the point is, you don't afterwards go out to do what you have seen, but in a sense you have almost been, how should we put it, cleansed of it, or it's acted as a kind of a catalytic agent for you, you see, to go in there and see it. Don't forget that the relation of viewer to cinema screen basically is that of a peeping Tom. You are a voyeur. And it's well known that voyeurs and peeping Toms usually are not the ones that commit violent sexual crimes. And it's well known that the people who go to these pornographic films very often are meek, middle-aged or elderly men, or of course also young people for their own reasons. But in general, they don't rush out, you know, and start raping women right in front of that movie house or elsewhere. This correlation has never yet been sustained in terms of research. In fact, there's a very impressive and important volume. There was a presidential commission established, I think, by President Johnson on obscenity and censorship. And they published a book, which is available as a paperback, I think, through Bantam, where these questions are detailed. You know, the research is pointed out. And they all came to the same conclusion. So this is an answer to what you said. I think there was something else you mentioned. Oh, whether you are sensitized or, what was the other thing?
Immunized.
Immunized, yes. You know, on that kind of question, I think we can only speculate. And needless to say, even some of the things I've said before remain still in this uncertain realm between careful scientific research and educated speculation, you know, which is quite subjective usually. So that we are not yet at the point where we can give definite answers to the kind of questions you're asking. I think it depends on the images. You see, this is a very subtle question. I think if you see a profoundly humanistic motion picture made by one of the great humanists of the cinema, you're going to be humanized by the images you see. And if you see, on the other hand, some of the crassly commercialized images that are being shown now in conventional present-day commercial films or television productions, more specifically, I think you're going to be dehumanized by them. I think that when you present however wonderful motion picture on problems in concentration camps and how people survived by playing in an orchestra, as I saw a couple of weeks ago, you know, on national TV, and you follow a particularly sensitive scene with a commercial in which you show an American housewife trying to get a little spot out in the kitchen with a particular kind of brand of cleaner, which of course is clearly displayed, you may be sure. And this happens right after the scene of a concentration camp where you'd need a hell of a lot of cleaners, you know, to clean that up. And then the next commercial is the jeans again, you know, Sassoon with that beautiful little jingle they have. To me, that's a desensitizing, dehumanizing experience, which tells you that the commercials are on the same level of importance as the visual material that has preceded them, which also means they're both on the same level of unimportance. Nothing matters. Everything is equally important, no matter what you see up there. It's like wallpaper. And And that to me is a, if you want to call it, a desensitizing experience. So actually I decided to turn the set off and not to look at that.
That's interesting. Amos Vogel is my guest, if you're just joining us, and he's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication, where he also runs the film program, and he's been working with film for many years, directing a number of film programs and film festivals. And beginning this Thursday, he'll also be hosting a series on Channel 12, a series highlighting the work of independent Philadelphia filmmakers. Now, you've made a very interesting argument against censorship, and even against self-censorship, because you said at one point, it better to see it than to avert your eyes. I just wonder if you've ever seen a film or an image within a film that you wished you hadn't seen, not because it was bad art and not because it was really boring, but because there was something deeply ugly, something very, very ugly or very, very repulsive or just horrible, which you couldn't get out of your mind and which haunted you in ways that you wished it hadn't.
Of course. Well, first of all, anybody would. For the simple reason that, you know, we're all born with a, we don't quite know what that beast is, but it has sometimes been referred to as the unconscious. And it has to do with our earlier life and our experiences and the way our parents treated us and how often we were beaten or whatever may have happened to us in our very early years. And there's not the slightest doubt that every one of us responds to different kinds of stimuli in a very negative fashion. So if you ask me that question, I remember I was rather surprised when this happened to me because I've seen, since I've spent my entire life looking at films, I've seen probably any conceivable image or combination of acts or actions that one could possibly think of, you know? And yet, I remember, this must have been at least 15 years ago, that I found it extremely difficult, and I was totally unprepared for that, by the way. I saw an eye operation, a documentary of the operation on an eye, in which the eye was literally removed from the socket during the operation, afterwards replaced, no problem. However, I was very disturbed by that. And this is interesting, because, of course, you need the eyes to see a film, you know. And there's no peeping Tom without eyes. So you could, even that could be psychoanalytically interpreted. Why that rather than something else, you know? And everybody has their own particular, quote, breaking point. Actually, I didn't walk out on that either. But I was fascinated and thought about it a great deal, why this would have happened. And then very recently, I had another instance of that. In a film which, by the way, I recommend to your audience, The Tin Drum, the German film by Schlöndorff. That film is important not only because it's an interesting and important film, but because it has a larger than usual percentage of images that address themselves more directly to the subconscious mind than many other films I've seen in recent, I would almost say years, at least in a commercial cinema, not outside of commercial cinema. So there was one image in that film, which, by the way, a great many people have commented on with, who have seen the film. It's very hard to describe if you haven't seen it, but it has something to do about some strange dead animal in the ocean. And I think it's the carcass, the head of a dead animal. And in its mouth are fish, I think dead fish or...
they were eels.
Eels, yeah, I'm sorry, eels I meant. But that whole image and also the way it continues, that really got to me. And of course, again, you know, a good session with a good psychiatrist would probably get to certain more basic aspects of that. But anyway, if you ask me, you know, these would be two examples. I think we should all talk about images that... affect us deeply. I think it'd be very good if people did that rather than to talk about some of the rather inane or superficial things that we like to talk about.
So those disturbing images are ultimately going to be something of interest for you to think back on and regard and wonder why they were disturbing to you, as opposed to a reason to protect yourself from certain films.
Oh, absolutely. I'm very happy I saw those images, and they taught me something about myself, and that's what I'm interested in.
What do you think of the rating system? Because there's now a code which I guess is supposed to serve a dual purpose. One, to like inform us what we're in for, and two, to protect certain members of the society of certain age from seeing things that, that the film board thinks they shouldn't be exposed to.
You know, I don't know where to begin. I mean, you know, protect. It's so beautiful how a society that doesn't protect most of its population against, in terms of anything, you know, old age, security, employment, freedom of human expression, suddenly becomes terribly protected about somebody seeing a little bit too much breast or having a little bit too much violence or something. That, to me, this is totally hypocritical. And of course, I'm against the rating system, and I think it is, it's very humorous to see there was recently a long debate in the New York Times between people from the rating system and members of the audience or critics as to whether this is censorship or not. And the amusing thing was that the people who are in charge of the rating system proclaim it isn't censorship at all. This is, of course, totally ludicrous. They are saying, well, look, we're not telling you what you should make. We're just then classifying it. However, first of all, it's not true that they're not telling them, because all the time I know about filmmakers who make a film and then they're told, well, if you're going to leave it the way it is, it's going to have an X. And you know, if you get an X, it means you're losing most of your audience. And if you have a R, it's not as good as a PG in terms of number of people who will come, who can come. Let's put it that way. So there's a financial and economic penalty exacted. And actually what it is, it's a system of self-censorship, which in fact, by the industry, which in fact is in some respects worse than a legally instituted censorship system, because with a legal system, there are ways in which this can be attacked through the courts. And this system is self-censorship, cannot be attacked, and the censorship takes place before the fact. That means the director or the person who puts up the money, sometimes even in thinking about a subject, will say, well, this won't go. I'm going to get an X or R. I don't want that. Or after they have made it, begun to write it and say, begin to shoot it, they're then going to exercise self-censorship in terms of what is going to go into a particular shot. So that it never even reaches a stage where the people at the rating system have to deal with it. And they think they're, you know, the biggest Democrats around, and I don't think so at all. And by the way, I worked with Jack Valenti quite closely at the time when this was first developed, because I was the head of the Lincoln Center Film Department and New York Film Festival. And I know what, you know, in terms of what the intention of the industry was, there was no secret about it.
What was the intention?
It was to protect the industry from state censorship. They didn't want somebody on the outside to come in and censor. Therefore, they were going to do the job themselves. Now we've gotten to the point where they pretend that they're not even doing that. They're just, you know, they're sitting there giving out little X's and R's, and it doesn't mean anything they say. No, I'm not in favor of it. I think it has prevented many interesting films and filmmakers from seeing the light of day, and we will never know. We will never know.
Would you like to see anything substituted in its place, or do you think that there should be no rating system at all?
You know, all these comments are, of course, subject to, misunderstanding, because they have to be placed into a context for which we haven't got the time to. We haven't got the time. I am not in favor of censorship. I'm against censorship. And I feel that human beings have the capability, just as I do, to decide what to see or what not to see, and to protect our kids. I'm very protective of children, by the way. To protect them from that kind of thing, I think in a society in which these kinds of things happen all the time on the street, in the schools, everywhere, is in a certain sense ridiculous. It just doesn't work, because these kids are much more savvy than we adults think they are. Perhaps unfortunately so. I don't say that I am happy about some of the things the kids see in school or on the streets. Of course not. But, you know, I mean, we don't have to talk about the realities, particularly of our urban centers, you know. And so to just take one little aspect and say, I'm going to protect that, it doesn't work to me, and it doesn't, and it's against my concept of what democracy is all about.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners who are just joining us. I'm speaking with Amos Vogel, who is a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication and the director of the film program at the Annenberg Center. He's formerly the director of the New York Film Festival, of the Lincoln Center film program. He's written extensively about film in many magazines, including The Village Voice and Film Comment, and is the author of the book Film is a Subversive Art. And he'll be hosting a television series here on Channel 12 featuring some of the films of Philadelphia independent filmmakers, and we'll be hearing about that series in a little while on Fresh Air. I'm sure you're aware of some of the boycotts that have been staged recently against films, and on different levels, some of them on small scale, some of them on larger ones. Many people boycotted the film Cruising when that was out. Certain women's groups are boycotting Brian De Palma's Dressed to Kill. There was a sizable Jewish boycott of the made-for-television movie Playing for Time. What are your opinions of this this approach to not, I guess, censoring a movie, but boycotting it as a way of registering your protest of the statement that the film is making?
I'm in favor of it. Yes. You see, now you have to understand very clearly what I'm saying here. I'm against anybody telling me you must not see this film or this film must not be produced. I'm totally in favor of anyone, including myself or any other group, coming and boycott or picket a theater for showing a certain film. I think they are exercising their democratic rights, and I think this is the way it ought to be in a society that at least claims to be a democratic society. So that, for example, I thought that Cruising was an absolute horror and a disgrace, I mean, to put it mildly from my point of view. And the kind of ideology expressed in Dressed to Kill toward women, and also in some other films of this type, is very offensive to me. And not only to women, but for that matter, to transvestites in Dressed to Kill, if you remember the film. It's really very kind of very cheap and vulgar, and in the social context, really reactionary kind of thing to do, from my point of view, because I don't think these minority groups should be portrayed in a stereotyped and offensive fashion. So that I'm perfectly in favor of anybody boycotting or picketing. But I'm not in favor of these same groups, and here's where I part company with some of my best friends, by the way, both among gays and among feminists, say in relation to these two films. I'm not in favor of their coming out and saying, stop the production of the film, or don't have it even come out. I don't know if that's the complete answer. There's a larger answer, but that, you know, it would lead us too far afield. It has to do with the fact that, of course, films are commercial products, are made for profit and for financial return, and whether, therefore, one can support a production of that sort dealing in such a manner with such a product, or whether one should defend, in terms of, you know, the First Amendment, and our democratic rights, the right of a venal producer to make a film like, say, Cruising, you see? That's where there may be possibly certain problems in my position. However, I have not come to the point where I plan to change it. You know, it's known, for example, that people like Herbert Marcuse, you know, came out in favor, ultimately, of censorship of certain kinds. A certain kind of, not the usual kind of censorship, but he would have been in favor, say, of censoring, of not producing Cruising or Dressed to Kill, if he had been in charge of film culture in the United States. And I did not agree with him, though I agreed with him on many other points in relation to other questions.
It's an interesting thing. I wonder if you can think of any films that you've seen where you thought that the film as a film was really wonderful, although you disagreed with the filmmaker's politics or perhaps
yes,
some of the political statements of the film. I mean, do you differentiate between the two? And do you think
that
some films are definitely worth
God,
seeing?
God, you're really digging up all the most important issues of, you know, cinema, philosophy of cinema. Well, you know, the best example of that, I suppose, in my life is Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, which is the most important, most famous propaganda film ever made, a feature-length film made by a woman for the Nazis, for the German fascists during the Nazi period in Germany. Well, and I myself, I'm a victim of the Nazi period, of course. I had to leave Austria and come here. Part of my family were killed. And yet, one of the things I did when I came here and started Cinema 16 as a film society, one of the first things I did was to show this film at that film society. And by the way, a great many people in New York were totally opposed to me at the time and very upset that I was doing that. And I felt it was absolutely necessary to show the techniques used by the fascists to put their point across. One had to learn that. One had to see that in action. Now, why the second reason was important because it was done so well. Otherwise, the film wouldn't have worked if it hadn't been done so well in terms of how to edit, what images to put in what order, what kind of music to choose, etc. Leni Riefenstahl, as far as I'm concerned, I continue to say this now, I'll say two things about her. One, I think she's probably one of the three most important women filmmakers in the world, if not the most important one, and the film is a masterpiece. And two, of course, she was a fascist, though she pretends even now, she was recently on 60 Minutes, not to ever have been one. And that's a beautiful story. I suggest your audiences either read some of the stuff I wrote or some of the stuff Susan Sontag wrote, a friend of mine. Anyway, the point there being that she is a fascist. She was a fascist. She supported and encouraged that regime, right, without the slightest doubt. And yet she made a film, when you look at it, you know, as a formal structure. You have to say that this film, in terms of what cinema is indeed a masterpiece. So it's a masterpiece of evil. How about that?
But it's important to show it.
It's essential to show it. It's, again, it comes down to the same thing. You see, whatever we are capable of doing as human beings, so what should be showable. That, you know what I mean. That's the way I look at things. And in some instances, indeed, there's an absolute advantage. It's positive to show it, such as how to explore how your enemies use the medium for their own purposes.
What effect do you think all these boycotts are going to have on the making of commercial films?
What kind of films? You mean?
Well, do you think that people are going to, that producers are going to examine scripts more closely and to see if they're politically righteous or not before
financially backing
them?
Oh, of course. It happens all the time, yes. And we're getting into, in a sense, more and more, not blandness, but non-controversial subjects. You know, that's why it's also important to have radio programs such as this, because, you know, when you look at the mass culture as a whole, there's a total. Everybody stays away from controversy, and everybody goes in for safe things and things that won't disturb you too much, won't have these disturbing images we've talked about. And as a result, you know, everybody sort of walks around in a kind of a zombie-like fashion. And there is something called the TV generation now, and I have contact with some of them, both privately and in my professional life. I'm talking about students or just people I know. And I'm sometimes quite not only horrified, but rather pessimistic about what I see. I think there are many changes taking place that are not for the better.
Well, there isn't really time to talk about this, but it's interesting to me that a film like Dress to Kill has raised so much controversy around it when it's such, I don't know, it seems to be such a well-made movie, and I can think of so many extremely sexist movies that aren't maybe literally sexist, that where the sexism is like more subtle, and even the, maybe the filmmaker had really good intentions. Maybe the filmmaker thinks of himself as being a fabulously liberal, all-knowing kind of person, and is so unaware of their own biases that it's really annoying to watch it. And something like that will be applauded.
I think this film is an unimportant event in terms of censorship, and I'm sorry that there's so much talk about it, actually. And I think it's extremely well made. By the way, he was first introduced at Cinema 16, in case you're interested, Brian De Palma, and extremely well made. And I think there are other films that are far more pernicious from that point of view, as you pointed out, and no one says a word about them. People don't even realize that they're looking at a film that puts down women in the most violent fashion, but also doesn't do it explicitly. And some of these films are seen much more widely than this film will be. And, you know, I don't know. It's a very pervasive thing. The problem is that women are not accepted as equals in our society, which, of course, is totally ludicrous. They are half of the human race, I'm happy to say. So,
We only have a few minutes left, and I want to spend some time talking about the TV series that's coming up. But I'm just wondering, in your limited hours per day that you have to devote to film going, how do you divide your time between independent films and commercial films? Because I guess that you'd want to be seeing as much as everything as you can, but there's only a certain number of hours per day.
It's an impossible task.
Yeah.
And I see some of everything. I see a lot of commercial films, I see a lot of independent films, and I see a lot of foreign films. I see a lot of films that don't even get shown commercially in the United States. I go to private previews, private screenings, people send films to me, what have you. So I try to do some of everything. Obviously, I spend a lot of time looking at independent films for a simple reason that not too many other people necessarily are in a professional sense. And I feel it's very important. And that's one of the reasons why I was so happy to accept the invitation of the public TV station here, Channel 12, to prepare the series, select the films, write the commentary, and be the host. Films from this area, you know, it's the Delaware Valley, and there are 5 1.5-hour programs that are going to be presented.
Now, that starts this Thursday, and the series is going to be the second Thursday of every month, and it's called Real Philadelphia, that's R-E-E-L, and it's a series of Philadelphia independent filmmakers' films. And what are we in store for on this? Can you tell us a little bit about some of the films and filmmakers whose work we'll be seeing?
Well, I saw about, I think, 60 or 70 films, and I selected about 12. And they go into various directions. There are some documentaries, there are some perhaps more avant-garde or experimental type of films, some animations, some are short, some are long. There are films like, some of them are quite strange, in fact, and those, if anything, are perhaps even more interesting to me than others. There's one called Virginia by Alan Bloom, which is really which shows in a very strange, peculiar way the subjugation or an attempted subjugation of one human being by another human being. There are documentary films such as We the People about the poor people in Kensington, and that is paired on and their struggles with their landlords and what have you. That's paired on the same program with a visit to Hirschhorn's palatial mansion, where we see his stupendous art collection. But, you know, both of these are shown in the same program, so that's kind of a comment of sorts. There's a film in which the filmmaker cajoles and attacks the audience and asks the audience to do certain things. I mean, the viewing audience, you know, from the screen. There's a film in which you can learn how to make pizza. However, that's really one of the most fascinating films in the program because there's this pizza maker and he shows you step by step, like Julia Child's, how to go about making a pizza, shows it to you, etc. However, there's a very strange and peculiar twist to this film, which I think I cannot reveal at this point. I would suggest your audience tune in. I think it's being shown this Thursday, in fact. And that twist has a lot to do with what film is all about. Film is an artificial creation, and it can be used and is used always in a manipulative sense, either for good purposes or for bad purposes, either consciously or unconsciously. But we have to be very careful to protect ourselves against it. I say this as a film person. It's very easy to fall prey to what is being said, and that's why these films, for example, against women or against blacks or against gays are so, you know, in that sense, pernicious. It's very easy to be manipulated by it, and we have to learn develop a kind of visual literacy in order to remain free while viewing a film. That's a very difficult thing to do, because film is an extremely persuasive and seductive medium, very seductive. And seduction isn't always necessarily good. It depends. It has to be a good seduction to be good.
One of the problems that many independent filmmakers have faced is the inability to find ways to reach the audience. Because, well, TV has traditionally been closed to films like that. There are small screening houses, but only people in the know where they are and know how to find them. Do you think that this is something we might be seeing more of, this alliance between television and independent filmmakers? Because it is a way to see the kinds of films that you don't find at commercial movie houses.
Well, I would hope there is. I would hope that there is such a connection, but I'm not terribly optimistic about it. I think television, even more so than commercial movie houses, goes after the largest possible market. And I think that every such gesture as this series should be supported. By the way, I've done this kind of thing elsewhere in the country as well. But I'm sure that there will be other series here in Philadelphia as well. We are hoping that this will become an annual series, in fact. But at the same time, I don't fool myself about thinking that the independents will take over, commercial television. I don't think so.
Okay.
Not quite.
Well, the series that Amos Vogel is going to be hosting is called Real Philadelphia, and it starts on Channel 12 Thursday between 9:30 and 11. And if you want to see these independent films by Philadelphia filmmakers, it's on the second Thursday of every month. And the films were selected by Amos Vogel, and he is also hosting them, and we'll be discussing each film before you see it on TV. Now, you also run a film program in West Philadelphia at the Annenberg Center. Are those screenings open to the public? That's not running anymore?
No, not at the moment. No, it's not running at the moment. At the moment, I'm simply teaching there. And the word simply is not well put, because
right. It's
a very all-encompassing task.
Okay. Well, Amos Vogel is a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication and is actually based in New York and has written extensively about film in journals, magazines, newspapers. His book is called Film as a Subversive Art, and that was published in the mid-1970s. Amos Vogel, I want to thank you very much for coming here and speaking with us this afternoon on Fresh Air.
Thank you. I was delighted.
That was Amos Vogel, and that's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. It's about 2 minutes to 5 o'clock. We'll be joining NPR for All Things Considered in just a couple of minutes. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by Dr. David Burns of Philadelphia, who's just written a book about his approach to working with clients who have problems with depression. So he'll be with us tomorrow at 2 o'clock. John Swed will be here at 3:30 to review new jazz releases, so I hope you can join us then. Technical director for today's show was Joyce Lieberman. Production assistance provided by Maeve McGoran. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening.